The main instigator of this war has been, since the beginning, Great Britain. The United States was going along until Trump came into power, and the British, when the war started, they set up this thing called Project Alchemy at the British Ministry of Defense, and it was a, it is or was a small cabal of academic intelligence and military veterans who kind of brainstormed about the war and who produced a document titled something like Ukraine, the Next Chapter, and then subtitle exploring the strategic options for war or what, you know, something to that effect.
Good afternoon, Alex. How's it going, man?
It's going well, Andy. Good to join you again.
Well, thank you so much for being on, and interesting and scary and exciting times all wrapped into one. Let's start with what happened recently in the Ukraine-Russian conflict, or you can call it war. They're calling it Russia's Pearl Harbor. Work that out for me. What's going on, and how do you see this? Do you see this escalating even more from there, or how does this get resolved, if at all?
Okay, so one thing that I need to point out is that the main instigator of this war has been, since the beginning, Great Britain. The United States was going along until Trump came into power, and the British, when the war started, they set up this thing called Project Alchemy at the British Ministry of Defense, and it was a, it is or was a small cabal of academic intelligence and military veterans who kind of brainstormed about the war and who produced a document titled something like Ukraine, the Next Chapter, and then subtitle exploring the strategic options for war or what, you know, something to that effect. And so basically they spell out a couple of very important things in that document, the most important of which is, in several times they underscore that we need to keep Ukraine fighting. So their logic is that the longer the war drags on, the more the Russians are going to be losing legitimacy in the eyes of the global public, and the more ridiculous they're going to look to the whole world, and the weaker Vladimir Putin's position in Russia is going to be. And they also say that the longer the war goes on, the more opportunity British intelligence services will have to run, sabotage operation, terrorism. You know, they even mentioned Gladio-style terrorist attacks on Russia. And so what happened on Sunday, last Sunday, was a almost exactly something that they described. And then, you know, when in January of this year, Keir Starmer signed a 100 years partnership agreement with Ukraine, there was a lot of talk about them developing Ukraine's defense together, and there was a lot of talk of drone technologies. So I think that the attack was planned and orchestrated and executed by Ukrainian intelligence, but supported by the British, MI6 or SAS or whoever, and probably rogue elements of the CIA in the United States. you know, the Ukrainian intelligence services are basically pretty much the creation of Western intelligence agencies. One U.S. official even called them, it's Ukrainian, SBU is our little baby now. And so they have been coddling this little baby and pretty much telling them what to do, how to do it. And we can even see that from the nature of the attacks, because they went through a lot of trouble to target Russia's nuclear bombers. If the sole objective was to just harm Russia, they could have done a whole lot of different things. You know, they could have targeted refineries, power plants. They could have targeted civilian airports. They could have inflicted, you know, with a successful attack, they could have inflicted far more damage on Russia than they actually did. I think that the reason why they chose specifically these nuclear bombers is because it crosses the line of Russia's nuclear doctrine. And by doing that, I think that they were hoping that the Russians would respond by launching possibly nuclear or maybe conventional missile attacks against Western targets, because the nuclear doctrine spells out that if a non-nuclear power strikes at them, which is Ukraine, but they're aided by a nuclear power, then Russia reserves the right to strike back at that nuclear power, which helped in executing and planning the attacks. So, you know, Russia, from its own point of view, now has justification to strike at NATO, Britain, Germany, maybe France, I don't know. And I think that this is what the attack was trying to achieve. They were trying to get the Russians to fall into the provocation, launch attacks at NATO targets in Western Europe, and then they could invoke Article 5 and say, like, hey, you know, it's the big war, we go all together and go kill Russia. But I think that the Russians understand this. They know that this is a provocation, and they will not give these Western oligarchies the most precious gift that they could give them right now, because things are imploding in Western Europe. The social, economic, political crises are at a boiling point. A World War III against an external enemy would be just what the doctor ordered for them. And the fact that the Russians are, you know, understand this implies that they will almost certainly not give them that gift.
Okay, so in my opinion, and I'm not speaking for you, but it sounds like you share the same opinion, Russia's showed remarkable restraint, if you would. And then do you think that they will always be restrained here? And then what exactly is it going to take? And I certainly pray and hope that this is not the case. What is it going to take then to get World War III between Russia and the West, really, NATO? What's going to take to make that happen? And do you think that because of the restraint, that this is more or less not a high probability?
Well, I think that what it would take would be a successful false flag attack in Western Europe. You know, last time I looked, which was just a few weeks ago, all the webcams around the city of London, with maybe one or two exceptions, are still dark. They went dark in September of last year. I don't know why they went dark, but it's very bizarre that a major city with hundreds of webcams all around, all of a sudden, they all went dark. And so to me, that's an indication that they're preparing something, and they could be preparing like a nuclear explosion above London or a dirty nuke. And I think that the British secret services have probably collected enough missile and bomb fragments in Ukraine from Russian missiles they could then spread that around London and say, like, hey, look, you know, it was the Russians. We found all these fragments. So I think that that could be in the works. I don't know if they're actually going to do it, but they are doing something, because there is no explanation why the webcams went dark and stayed dark for months and months and months. There's going to be a reason for it. You know, if one or two went dark, or a couple of them went dark randomly, but all of them, that's, you know, that's something to pay attention to. And so, you know, maybe that's also part of the reason why the British are being increasingly open about their role. They're no longer hiding, you know, at least since the Kursk incursion in August last year. They haven't been hiding their role. They have been quite open. And I think that they're maybe trying to draw a Russian response. And then, you know, they could say, like, oh, look, or maybe just get the Russians to speak in such a way to make everyone think that, oh my God, the Russians are going to attack Great Britain. But Russians have to be very, very careful. They have not, they have been open about, yeah, the Brits are the chief instigator, but they never suggested even remotely that they have any intention of attacking the UK or retaliating or launching missile strikes or anything of the sort. So there have been no threats issued towards the UK. So, you know, the Brits are now kind of grappling for straws, and, you know, Keir Starmer, even though there has been no response from Russia, he's saying, oh, look, you know, the world is so dangerous and we have to rearm, we have to prepare for war. They're doing it all to themselves, by themselves. And he's even said that the rise in the cost of living is because the Russians are threatening them. I mean, it doesn't make, you know, it's completely nonsensical, but they are, I think that they are quite, quite desperate. And I think that, you know, the UK is looking at a possible civil war in not too distant future. And so they're, you know, they're desperate for a foreign enemy and a foreign war, and they're trying to provoke it in any which way they can. And I think that they also think that if they get themselves into a whole lot of trouble, that the United States would have no choice but to come to their aid. And then they get their big war by hook or by crook. But so far, it's not happening that way.
Okay, so where does this leave NATO and also the U.S. In this, even though U.S. is a part of NATO? Does it just leave, hey, let's wait and see if there's going to be a response, or do they just continually provoke?
Well, I think that they're going to provoke as in so far as they can. You know, these operations that they launched last Sunday, they took a long time to plan and execute, and then subsequently they launched a sea drone into one of the carrying pillars of the Kirk Bridge, but it didn't do much damage because the Russians built a protective barrier around them, so nothing much happened there. So, you know, will they be able to mount something as well planned and sophisticated as they have done last week? I don't know. I don't see that you can keep running these things one after the other, because it takes a lot of time and resources to plan this and organization to execute it properly. So I think it's going to be difficult for them. But one of the ways in which they're trying to exacerbate things is through PSYOP, through propaganda wars. And so they are, you know, they're trying to make the impression on everyone that that Ukraine has still a lot of fight in them, that they are capable of all these incredible Mission Impossible attacks on Russia, that, you know, they're trying to give everybody the impression that it's worth supporting Ukraine, that it's worth aiding Ukraine by, you know, by maybe even putting boots on the ground and giving them long range weapons and all of these things. The Brits have, you know, they haven't been explicit or overt about this, but they have been looking to helping Ukraine get nuclear weapons. So, you know, they will try propaganda, they will try diplomacy, you know, they will try to exert pressure on the United States to rejoin Project Ukraine and recommit to providing security guarantee for Ukraine. You can see that they're going after Trump because Trump is in their way. You know, they're trying to delegitimize him, to disqualify him, to say that he has no control, that he doesn't know what he's doing. They might try to assassinate him. You know, they've done it before. They might do it again. But I think that, you know, Trump understands this. The Russians understand this. And I think that the opposition to the Project Ukraine in the United States is, it's not just Trump. I'm increasingly getting impression that the opposition is far more robust and widespread than we know, because the more you look into Project Ukraine, the more you see that it's very incompatible, in fact, with U.S. interests. There are some people like the Bidens, like Lindsey Graham, like, you know, probably a number of people in the banking industry and in the, you know, various corporations, BlackRock and so on, who have interest in Ukraine and who would prefer a Western-aligned government to stay in power in Kiev. But I think that broadly speaking, for the American society, for the American economy, this project has been a disaster. It's only cost a lot of money and weapons, and it hasn't brought much benefit at all. Bulk of the benefits, if the project turns out to be successful, will go to the Brits and Europeans, primarily French.
You mentioned that this is really started by the Brits, but it's really because I would involve, I guess, and I'm not speaking for you, but my own thoughts involve most of Western Europe involved in this, Macron, et cetera. But you mentioned that Western Europe is imploding and Britain is on the verge of a civil war. Is it just because of their economy completely tanking here? Work that out for me.
That's certainly part of it, but it's not, you know, Britain is not the only one that's going in the direction of civil war. It's France as well, possibly Germany. I don't know, Holland, maybe Belgium. Things are getting very tight, and these things appear almost unthinkable. But, you know, I know that military circles in France actually believe that the most likely way that this crisis unravels is going to be through a civil war, and they are actually preparing for it. The huge part of the problem is economic. You know, we are on the verge of a very severe financial crisis, which will probably not take place in the same way as the last one did in 2008. You know, like a Lehman Brothers moment, and then everything collapses, because at that time, and then again during the, you know, behind the pandemic smokescreen, the bankers actually staged something of a coup where they've taken control of the printing presses and of the monetary policy completely. So they will not allow one of their corporations or one of their banks to go under. You know, some small regional banks, local banks, they might go under, you know, due to market forces, but the G-SIBs, the global systemically important banks, they will be getting backstops from central banks to infinity. So banks are not going to go under. But what's going to happen is that by flooding the system with all this liquidity, you're going to erode the currency. So you're going to have the cost of living crisis. You're going to get high levels of inflation. And I think that for Europe and for the UK, there's a good chance that inflation accelerates to a hyperinflation, and that's collapse, that's total collapse. And, you know, if you had an evil external enemy that we all have to come together, close ranks behind our valiant leaders and go and kill the enemy, then, you know, that would bail them out. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, you mentioned inflation and possibly hyperinflation. I always thought that deflation is very underrated. Not that I want deflation, but it's very underrated. Inflation and in hyperinflation is what collapses an economy.
Yes.
And is that what we're seeing now in not only gold prices, but a lot of industrial metals as well? A lot of commodity prices, with the exception of oil, which I think is more than likely being manipulated. And we can talk about that. But we're seeing really, really high prices in gold, silver, copper, et cetera. Is that why? Because that's sniffing out a possible hyperinflation?
I think so. You know, over the last 2 or 3 years, that's even more disturbing. It's been the central bankers who have been the main buyers of gold. And my understanding is that most of this gold buying has been done privately and secretly. And what does that tell us? That tells us that the central bankers around the world no longer have confidence in their currencies.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, you know, the reason why they're trying to keep it hush-hush is because they don't want us to get the wind of it and start, you know, dumping the currency and buying gold and precious metals and commodities and, you know, what have you. So they've been preparing for a crash that they know is coming. Mm-hmm. And I think that the buying of gold by central bank has exceeded $8 billion a month. So that's very significant. Then don't forget that there's a $200 or $220 trillion shadow banking system, where last I heard, and that was just a few weeks ago, okay, maybe a few months ago, I'm not 100% sure, but their average allocation to gold was, I think, less than 1%. And, you know, it's gold, the whole thing, my understanding, is worth about $20 trillion. The whole entire gold market, but of which only a small part of it is actually being actively traded. You know, a lot of it is jewelry, stuff that people have at home, or in storage, or, you know, in vault somewhere. The part that's being traded is less than half of that. And so if only a fraction of, so, you know, for your viewers, the shadow banking system is hedge funds, pension funds, endowments, charities, insurance companies, these, you know, financial non-banking institutions. But they have a lot of investable liquid capital under their control. And it would be enough for just a fraction of these money managers around the world to say, oh, gee, look, gold is going up. Maybe we need to increase our allocation to gold. And so, you know, that could put huge upward pressure on the price of gold. If they say, go, okay, we have 1% or less, maybe we want to double that, maybe we want 2% allocation to gold. Well, that would be enough to you know, put gold at 5,000 or maybe higher than that. So I think it's loss of confidence. And bizarrely, it started, you know, the central banks are the ones who catalyzed this move.
Yeah, it is bizarre once you start thinking about it and once you start working through it. And they've been typical shunners of gold or hard assets well within the last couple of decades. So there is an irony there. Work out for me a little bit. What is Germany going to do specifically in all of this? We've talked previously where you would saw them, or I don't want to say you saw them, but you made the suggestion that they should go east and realign with Russia because they don't have any good neighbors. Do you still see that as a potential case, or is that?
I think that that is a potential case, because that would be the most logical development for Germany. But you know, the current people in power are going the opposite way, and they're trying to repress the public through very heavy-handed censorship and very heavy-handed fines on anybody who is, you know, anybody who runs afoul of their censorship rules, which are very, very extensive. You know, like it's enough for you to say something pro-Russian in public, you get something like a 4,000 euro fine. If you ask the question, why are we supporting Ukraine? I think it's like something like 2,500 euro fine. So they're trying to scare people into silence, intimidate everybody into just kind of acquiescing passively, and then trying to escalate the war and do as the Britain does, hope that they could get a big war, evil external enemy, and then you can shove everything under the carpet. You can just tell everybody, oh, well, you know, your pensions are gone, but, you know, it's blame the Russians and there's no food. Well, you know, we have to feed the boys at the front. There's no medicines. Well, you know, as the you know, then you could blame Russians for everything. Not only that, but under the martial emergency, then you also get to deal with the opposition in a quick and efficient way. Without this emergency, you have a normal political process that is still alive, and people asking questions and people saying, hey, how come we're doing this? This doesn't make any sense. We don't want to go to war. We don't want our children to die for Ukraine. What are you people doing? And so, you know, the government is losing legitimacy. And I think that today it's very, very hard to repress the people completely because you have social media. They're trying to silence the social media. They're talking about it. They totally want to force the social media to police the discourse on their posts. But it's not quite working. It's very difficult to police. And so I think that there's a chance that there's the current government falls. It's already very unpopular, even though they only just took office. And in that case, you know, if you got somebody in the government like the AfD, then all bets are off. And I think that they would reach out to Russia. They would probably seek exit of Germany out of NATO and out of European Union. It would be a total game changer.
Yeah. No, it certainly would. And that's, I don't see the EU surviving or the euro surviving without Germany, the biggest economy over in Europe. So it's hard for me to see. I mean, yeah, I should say it's hard for me to see them surviving if that were to be the case. So I know that you're, as we become friends, that you're an active trader. You have a lot of experience in the hedge fund industry. And, you have services involving the financial services and your thoughts on all of that. I want to ask you really about bond rates and the Japanese yen carry trade. Excuse me. How does this, or does this at all play into this? And what I mean by that, it's really hard for economies to boom. Correct me if I'm wrong. When bond rates are going up or are going up as high as they are when they have historically been lower?
I don't know if that is the case, Andy, because, you know, there's actually no empirical evidence that low rates are good for economic growth and that high rates are bad for economic growth. It seems intuitive. But in actuality, it isn't like that. And empirically speaking, there's no evidence for it at all. Actually, there's a lot more evidence for the opposite. So, yeah, the carry trade, my understanding is that it's only partially unwind. that it's only partially unwound and that it's still on. And so, you know, that's going to potentially pressure bond rates higher, interest rates higher. It's a problem because as interest rates go higher, the value of bonds goes down. And, you know, that for a lot of banks and corporates, those bonds are the collateral that they use to fund their activities. And so it's going to be, it's going to be a crunch time, but for the fact that central banks are going to, I think there's no question about it, they're going to step in, they're going to provide all the liquidity that's necessary for the system, they're going to backstop all the bad losses, all the bad credit on banks' balance sheet, and the whole merry show is going to go on indefinitely until they destroy the currency, because, you know, you can only flood the liquidity into the system for so long before you, until you you trigger hyperinflation. And so that's coming. And I'm not sure what Trump administration is going to do about it. It's obvious that they understand that they have this problem and that they are looking to transition to a different monetary system. I've heard that they're thinking about a dual currency system, so that they introduce a domestic dollar and a foreign dollar, which makes a lot of sense. But, you know, let's find out, because nothing, you know, they're going to have to ambush us with this. You know, they're not going to be able to announce it. Oh, this is what we're going to do, and it's going to be effective, I don't know, September 1, because that would cause complete panic in the markets. So they're going to probably have to ambush us in some way, or they're going to let the crisis unravel, or maybe even help it. You know, with insane tariffs and everything, in order to say, okay, look, this is, we cannot carry on like this. Now we're gonna have a different currency system. So I don't know. I think it's a lot of guesswork, and we're gonna find out when we do.
Yeah. How would that work with two currencies here in the U.S.? You said you have a domestic dollar and then an international dollar. I'm trying to reconcile what you just said. How would that work?
It would probably work somehow as it does in China, because China has that, you know, they have the renminbi, which is the domestic circulation currency. And then they have the yuan, which they use for foreign trade. And that basically allows them to insulate the domestic economy from foreign shocks. And as you'll remember, in 1997, we had this big financial contagion across the whole Eastern Asia, yeah? So all the tiger economies basically collapsed, and their currency collapsed, except for China. And that's because they have this dual circulation system. And so I guess, you know, it would make sense for the United States to do something like that, particularly because there's about $32 trillion U.S. dollar denominated assets in foreign accounts, which, you know, if the dollar starts to tank, all of this might flood back in to sell it off. And then that could crash the markets. If you have dual currency, you can control capital flows going in and going out. You can restrict the sales. You can restrict exports of the drain of money out of the system. You can do a lot of things that could help you manage the crisis without being completely open to shocks from foreign markets.
That does not sound appealing to me. If we capital restrictions, if you would, or the government controlling capital flows, if you would. It seems like it'd be good for the oligarchs here in the U.S. that are in charge, the big banks that are in charge in the government, but it wouldn't be good for the middle classes or the poor.
Yeah, but the whole point of having dual currency system is to protect the ordinary people, because, you know, people who are sophisticated in financial markets, they will have options to protect themselves. You know, they'll have offshore bank accounts, they'll have hedge fund holdings and stuff like that. They've already hedged their bets. It's the ordinary people that are going to suffer the worst, and this is your economy, essentially. You know, if the ordinary people lose purchasing power, your economy is dead. So that's what you need to protect. But I agree with you that this is not appealing, because for the last 40, 50 years, we've lived and functioned in a system that seemed very, you know, flexible is not the right word. You know, it was open. You could invest abroad. You could invest in the United States. You could transfer money here and there without restrictions. It was all open and free, right? Free market. But the problem is that this system is unsustainable, and we're just going deeper and deeper and deeper into a crisis. And so if something is unsustainable, it means at some point it's not going to go on anymore. And so you have to transition to something new and different. At some point, I think we're nearing that point.
No, unfortunately, I agree with you. What is China's role in all of this, in this new global economy? How are they dealing with this Russia-Ukraine escalation here? And work that out for me.
Well, China is trying to create a whole alternative system for the world, not just for themselves. And so they, in 2013, they started this Belt and Road initiative. And so they're investing very heavily into that, you know, building out infrastructure, roads, railroads, shipping line, basically a system to facilitate trade between the nations of the world. And their strategy has been to help economies gain prosperity. You know, they have lifted 850 million Chinese out of poverty in the last 30, 40 years, which is creating an affluent middle class that has money to spend, that can absorb the output of the economy. And I think that they're doing the same throughout the global South, because, you know, they position themselves as a global manufacturing hub, and they want to have, you know, billions of affluent consumers everywhere around the world. So, you know, they're helping poor countries build out their infrastructure, port, nuclear power plants, things of that nature, so that their local economies develop. And I know one example, when I was at a conference in Germany, where there were many delegations from African countries and from Yemen, and they were all very, very upbeat about the role of China in their countries. And one young man from Yemen told me, here's how the Chinese have done it in Yemen. They said they came in and they built us a port for $500 million. And we didn't have money to pay this back. And so the deal turned out to be that the Chinese said, you don't have to pay us back now. You know, this port will help your country's economy develop. In another 20, 30 years, you will be able to pay us back, and then we'll talk about the payback. So, you know, this seems to be their outreach towards the world. Of course, it completely clashes with the Western colonial system, which has for hundreds of years done everything to keep the colonies poor, because they don't want to compete with them for the raw materials. You know, if If you have a very well developed economy in, I don't know, Nigeria, Burkina Faso, Cameroon, then they would absorb a lot of their own output. But if they're dirt poor and they need to sell everything to come up with hard cash to service the debts they have towards the Western financial systems, financial institutions, then they have to sell everything at the price that the West dictates, because, you know, West had unchallenged primacy for centuries, and so they were the only buyer, right? Western corporations, Western institutions. And so they deliberately wanted to keep all their colonies dirt poor. So that is leading us to a conflict. And, you know, remember George Soros already told us that the conflicts we're observing around the world, that they're essentially the conflict between two systems of governance. And so here, China is introducing something very different. A lot of nations are joining BRICS, BRICS Road Initiative. And now it's already very considerable. And this is very attractive because, you know, everybody wants peace, prosperity, free trade, you know, equitable terms so that everybody is better off rather than just somebody, just one side. But that at the same time is jeopardizing the privilege of Western oligarchies that have run the system for the last few centuries. And so they are, you know, they are desperate to destroy China, to destroy Russia, to reimpose their system on everybody. You'll own nothing and you'll be happy. That's the,
yes,
the model that they're proposing.
As the saying goes. So let's, I guess lessons with end with this is investors, or what should they be on the lookout? Again, you're having higher commodity prices, slowing economies, and it looks like we're going into the eye of this storm, potentially. I'm not saying that's where we're at, but we're potentially there going into it. The storm of geopolitical conflict here. What should people do?
Hang tight.
Good answer. I get this question all the time.
Next question.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that it makes sense to have a couple of months worth of food reserves. It makes sense to own some gold and silver to cover a couple of months of your expenses, to have some cash on hand to cover a couple of months of your expenses, to learn how to grow food, to learn how to cook. I always say that the most important thing is to reach out to your neighbors and get to know them, because, you know, the day when you can't solve your problems by going to Costco or Walmart or something like that, you might find out that you have a neighbor who can maybe fix your car for next to nothing, or that they could fix your roof, or whatever, that some neighbor has chickens and eggs, and some other neighbor grows potatoes and tomatoes and something. And so, you know, your biggest boost to your resilience is to have local network of people who are capable of coming to one another's aid and who are capable to render their services to their neighbors in exchange for whatever you can give them. You know, buy coffee, buy cigarettes.
Hey,
no.
Bullets?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, probably that too. But you know, there are certain things, you know, you want to have food in reserve.
Yeah, whiskey.
I know.
The bunk.
If things get really, really rough, you could get a lot of favors for, you know, a pack of coffee.
Yeah.
Or a carton of cigarettes.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's good to have those items when you go into crisis. You know, like I lived through a war And believe me, that comes in very handy. I forgot to mention toilet paper. Toilet paper is something that it seems to me that the people in power deliberately eliminate from the markets because it's hugely demoralizing, you know, and they do it on purpose. And we, you know, when former Yugoslavia started to go into a crisis and the wars of succession, one of the first things that disappeared of the shelves was toilet paper. But then when you know, things like sugar, cocoa, toothpaste, shampoo, and obviously coffee, and I don't remember whether we had cigarette troubles. I don't smoke, so I didn't pay much attention to that. But I know that in Russia they had like a tobacco shortage, and it was brutal because, you know, have a lot of people who are addicted to nicotine, and they just went insane. Sorry, not to nicotine. They're addicted to something else. I just saw some doctor saying that nicotine is not addictive, that it's other compounds in the in cigarettes that make you addicted. Yeah, people start to have temper issues when they don't get their fix.
And you can't smoke.
But for that reason, maybe it's good to have a carton of two or a carton or two of cigarettes.
Yeah, I actually love that advice. Funny anecdotal story during COVID. I'm in Atlanta here, and you couldn't find, there was a toilet paper shortage, using in air quotes. And I called a friend of mine that was literally, that lives literally an hour and a half away, and asked him if he had toilet paper up there. I said, yeah, we just got some in, and I drove up to get a case, and they rationed it to me. I can only buy one case at a time. So,
Interesting.
yes.
So all these things, you know, are good ways to prepare, but I think that far and away the most important is to not be isolated, you know, to really reach out to your neighbors. And you know, funnily enough, the authorities know this, and this is why they're desperate to prevent local communities from organizing. I was 3 years ago, I was invited to Ireland to a conference called Think Local. And so this was five very ordinary law-abiding Irish people who organized this. And the whole idea was just for people from the local community to get together, you know. We created an event. They invited, you know, a couple of speakers. I was one of them, and the rest was, you know, people bringing their, you know, showcasing their produce, whatever they do, and meeting and mingling and talking to each other over meals, over beers, over, you know, stuff. And it was very, very difficult for them to organize this event because the government was trying to prevent it from happening. And so this was February 23, and then they managed to organize it, but by organizing it at a false venue. So they advertised one venue after the government canceled two venues before that. So they advertised the third venue, but they actually organized an event at a completely different place. So somebody was at the fake venue telling people, sorry, it's not here. You have to go there. And that's how they, you know, beat the authorities. But when they tried to organize it again in July of 2023, the government was able to prevent it from happening. And they, you know, they already organized the whole thing, and then everybody had to disperse and leave.
This was in Ireland.
This was in Ireland, but you know,
Yes,
it goes to tell you, they really don't want people to organize locally. They don't want them to know each other. They don't want them to talk to each other. And you know, that tells you that it's actually probably important to do exactly that.
Well, Alex, you're a very busy man. I just want to leave. You become a really good friend, right? Somebody I look up to, somebody I love having on and having these discussions with. If people want to know more about you, how do they find you? And I'll put all of this information in the show notes on the YouTube channel and the Apple and Spotify podcasts.
Thank you, Andy. It's my pleasure. And people can find me on X. My handle is @NakedHedgy. And I have two publications on Substack. One of them is for investors and traders, a daily trend following newsletter called iSystem Trend Compass. And I also have a personal Substack where I publish less frequently, but I try to make it a bit more refined and more thoroughly researched, which is called Alex Craner's Substack. I have a website and a YouTube channel and a Rumble channel and all this, but it's easy enough to find me anywhere from those three that I mentioned.
It really is. Alex, I want to thank you again so much for your time. You always make time for me, and I'm so grateful for that. I just really enjoy our talks.
Thank you, Andy. It's a pleasure, and all the best until the next time.
Take care.
Take care, and bye-bye.